Welcome to Explain to Shane. I'm your host, Shane Tews at the American Enterprise Institute. On this podcast, I interview tech industry experts to explain how the apps, services, and structures of today's information technology system work and how they shape our social and economic life.
The internet has become a global tool revolutionizing communications and access to information for billions of people worldwide over the past several decades. However, despite its widespread adoption, there are still significant areas where around 3 billion people lacked access to the internet's transformative technology. Some argue that solutions lie in more fiber cable expansions, while others look towards innovation around satellites to meet users' demands. To discuss how it's possible to dynamically manage the multitude of global communication systems, including satellite constellations with mesh networks and terrestrial links, are today's guests Brian Barrett and Michael Chang of Alaria, a space connectivity company that is using the power of software-defined networking and advanced laser communication technology to manage the complex, interconnected networks of hybrid space architecture that help orchestrate the multi-domain, multi-orbit networks for secure communications for the defense and commercial markets. Brian Barrett is Alaria's Chief Technology Officer and co-founder, and has spent his career developing innovative ways to address connectivity challenges. He has worked as an engineer with NASA, Cisco, and Google, and most recently Meta's Innovation Labs, before starting Alaria. Michael serves as a member of Alaria's Board of Advisors, along with his role as Chief Product Officer and Executive Vice President of Corporate Development. Before joining Alaria, Michael served as Associate General Counsel for M&A at Meta, and as the lead of Meta's open source team. Tune in as Brian, Michael, and I discuss the vital roles of managing and optimizing complex satellite constellations as part of the transformation for making communications more robust and reliable on multiple platforms. Brian and Michael, welcome to Explain to Shane. I really appreciate you all being guests on today's show. You guys are doing stuff that is truly out of this world. I mean, it's like... You're outside of so many of us spend time thinking about broadband and digging ditches and hearing about labor issues. And then you're like, let's do this another way. Let's actually coordinate what's going on in space. So I'm super excited to hear about this. Tell me about your company. What are you guys up to? How long have you been doing it? Give me some basics here.
Yeah. Alaria is most often described as something of a Google spin out, but we're actually an independent company. We've worked together for many years, though, going back to probably about 2013, 2014, where at Google, our teams worked on ways to bring the next 3 or 4 billion people online to the internet. There's still about 3 billion people on the planet that don't have access to broadband internet. And while we were there, we looked at a bunch of different approaches to try to solve that problem. And that's something maybe we can talk about a bit more later in detail about, like, what are those problems? Where do they come from? And what do you need to do to solve them? But it turns out a large segment of those problems need to get solved by things that are higher than the altitude of a cell tower, by things that sometimes fly and move, satellites, airborne vehicles. And so our company develops technology that enable those sorts of networks and some of the unique operational challenges that they have. Since we were founded about 2 years ago, after we spun out from Google, we have like a number of contracts, a good amount of business going on, and we're starting to make have some really strong momentum towards that future.
So give us an idea where you are in the ecosystem. So you're not a satellite company. You're not throwing stuff into space. Tell us about, I guess, the partnerships and how are you managing the infrastructure in space? Because I see from what I'm reading about you all, you've got some ideas about how we could get better about this with your outer net. So keep going with the origin story onto the next page there.
Yeah. So maybe jumping in on the types of problems that we solve and then like how we do that with partners, there's kind of maybe two concrete challenges we help solve. When people think about internet access globally, people often focus on like the build out of cell towers or expansion of new satellite internet. But, you know, there's already been global internet coverage, just from a coverage standpoint, from satellites for a couple decades now. I mean, you could get satellite internet for a long time, but why didn't that solve the problem? Like, why you could get satellite internet, you know, on your airplane. It's not the best internet, performance for in-flight Wi-Fi. So there's clearly coverage globally, but why hasn't that solved the problem of global broadband. A lot of that has to do with altitude. It's this sort of same effect as if you took like a flashlight and you shined it over your desk, right? If you raise it high above your desk, that the light from that flashlight would cover a larger area, but the kind of the intensity of the light would go down. And as you move it towards the table, it gets brighter, but it covers less area. And the same thing's true with satellites. So historically, we've had satellites operating at 36,000 kilometers up in space. They're falling around the Earth at the same speed Earth rotates. And so they're always at the same place in the sky. And for decades, that's how satellite internet has worked. But the problem is, it's like the flashlight really far above the table. There's so little light per square mile or square area that you sell out of capacity. There's not enough capacity to support the billions of people that need it. So they do what any good business would do. They sell it to the people that can afford to spend the most money until they're out of capacity, which is why you really only see it used by things like in-flight Wi-Fi, where the cost of every byte or megabyte or gigabyte is quite high for the cost of a service delivery. And so the race to connect the unconnected involves often reducing the altitude of those satellites to get that brighter energy per square mile, per square kilometer, to connect the unconnected. But as soon as you get any lower than the height of those geostationary satellites, or any higher than the height of a cell tower, now the network itself is constantly moving relative to the Earth. It's no longer falling around the Earth at the same speed Earth rotates. It's falling faster than the speed at which Earth rotates. And in the case of a SpaceX Starlink, those satellites are whizzing by every couple minutes. And so they need to interconnect with each other and constantly hand off the connection to the user. There's a lot more operational complexity in those sort of networks. And so our company provides technology that solves two key problems there. One of them is the kind of software to be the sort of brain and orchestrator or kind of conductor of this constant dance of handovers of connections that have to happen, not only between the end user and the satellites flying by overhead, but the connections between the satellites and each other, and then back to the ground, so where they're getting their internet connection from to give it to you. So that's one of the key areas. The other one is more about that connection back to the Earth and making it larger and higher performance and faster speeds.
First, I love the analogy of the flashlight. That is probably the best way I've had anyone explain the height challenge, you know, because we're in the GEO, LEO, discussions right now. We just came out of the World Radio Conference and about, you know, spectrum and where we're going to manage this. And that was a big thing. People had to learn the difference between them. And then, you know, the base stations and all the fun stuff. But you hear about the component parts, but you don't hear about the complexity of the linking of all of this. And then just by the native of having multiple parts, you realize that there's all kinds of security issues, latency issues, resiliency issues. And it sounds like you have been working diligently for quite some time to solve many of those problems.
Yeah, another analogy we like to use is mobile towers in space, right? But instead of it being fixed, it's moving around around the globe at thousands of miles per hour. And then if you think back to the early 90s, or, you know, you used to have to, step outside your county and then you'd be roaming, right? And a lot of those roaming agreements came about through interconnection agreements from, you know, different satellite operators having to negotiate, you know, what is the cost of me servicing your user on my network, right? And so we're solving both of those issues, but one, which is incredibly fast, complex mobile towers in space, but also the interoperator sort of handover of that between different operators.
That seems like a lot to just manage from an information flow, you know, like who's where, whose equipment's whose, are we servicing this one and not that one? I mean, there's just a ton of things going on there. So give us an idea of how, well, let's start with the first one. So what are the security concerns around those things? Because you're obviously, you've got the ability for interference, and we're unfortunately in a land of where everything's, national security is trumping everything, including getting money or not getting money on communicating with people. So let's start with national security. How are you helping the process of making sure that those uplinks and downlinks are secured and not interfered with?
Yeah, so some of the same trends happening in the commercial industry are also paralleled in the public sector around the directionality of wireless signals. So the same reason that you would cup your hands to talk to someone that's farther away from you, that it helps the signal have more focused energy. So more signal gets to where you want it to go, gets you higher throughput at long range. So that's relevant for just this continuing trend on commercial side for the annual growth rate of the appetite of data that people have. They use more and more gigabytes every year for their internet applications and their web surfing and other things. But that same directionality, that same reason you cup your hands to talk and get more signal at distance, is also relevant from a national security and privacy standpoint, because it's a similar motion, if you would, that if you're trying to tell a secret to somebody, right, and you cup your hands to whisper into someone's ear, or to put your hand to maybe have your kids not hear what you're saying, you know, to someone in the same room. That directionality makes things harder to intercept and detect, right? And so this trend is happening across the board in these sort of long distance aerospace satellite kind of communication systems, that there's an increasing appetite for more highly directional steerable beams of energy. So you can do this with antennas that look like, you know, parabolic dishes, right? Like, you know, I think what most people imagine, like from the movie Contact or things with like NASA ground stations, right? These are big parabolic dishes that give you this really focused beam of energy. But there's other sorts of antennas that do this with electronic steerable beams, like phased arrays. And then the ultimate example of a really directional signal is laser communications with optical communications, which is a hardware technology that Elyria offers, also related to a project spun out from Google that has its roots in Lawrence Livermore National Labs. And with laser communications, it's sort of this ultimate example of a signal that the wavelength of light we use isn't visible to the human eye. And if you're not in the beam and where the beam is pointed, you know, you might only have tens of meters of beam spread, you know, over normal communications distances, where if you're not within those tens of meters of the target, you would never know the communications was happening. And so a lot of the work Elyria does is operating and orchestrating these sort of networks of these highly directional steerable beams, radio links and laser links, because of all the challenges that happen. If things are flying and moving all the time, if you just imagine a bunch of flying aircraft trying to build an interconnected mesh network with each other with laser links, you can imagine as the aircraft banks, the wingtip might get in the way and block the laser link, or the fuselage could have obstructions in certain angles. But you can anticipate these things a bit, you know, as the pilot's banking the aircraft, you can see these effects about to cause problems. And if you're fast enough and you apply enough compute, you can keep the network sort of orchestrated around a series of handovers that anticipate these sort of obstructions and set up new links before the old one is affected. And so this is the kind of software that we develop. Also hardware technology that we supply in these networks that's applicable to both the commercial space and the national security space.
One of the questions that came to mind when we were talking about this, is it still very much a military-based system, or are we seeing really serious commercial entities come online? I mean, I'm being very U.S.-centric in this, thinking about who we have in the space, and I realize that other countries don't maybe delineate them so much between the commercial and the in the military sector, but is it, and then do they share, or do they just only use their lane? They've got like an HOV lane of their, you know, they're military bound, and you let that traffic go right by.
So one of the things, that I learned, since spinning out, us starting to engage a little bit more with the U.S. public sector, is that, the Defense Department, the majority of satellite communications used for defense purposes are over commercial satellite networks. So there are government-owned, government-operated, and military SATCOM assets in space. There's plenty of them. I mean, it's a non-trivial minority. It's, I don't know what it is, if it's 80-20 or 70-30 towards commercial. But they buy a lot of connectivity, you know, between different places that need it around the world from commercial satellite internet providers. Or commercial, you know, just satellite connectivity providers that might not be connecting them directly to the internet. They're providing a private, you know, connection, you know, over and through a satellite network in space as a commercial company. And that same commercial company wholesales or direct to consumer sales connectivity services for entirely commercial purposes to enterprises or home internet access, right? So yeah, we do, you know, our technology is relevant to both segments. So there's commercial companies, you know, are on contract with us for our enabling technology for the software to operate and orchestrate, you know, their current or future networks. Also contracts for the laser communications hardware for their networks that they use to support commercial and government. But then there's also government-owned and operated systems that use it as well. And so we support on the public sector side, you know, the sort of defense and national security space, also civil space agencies like NASA, the European Space Agency, and NATO allied, you know, kind of countries and US allies.
Spectrum challenges we've been up against lately. I was talking to somebody from a South Asia country, and he was saying, well, we'll just use 3.5 for that. And of course, my mouth started being like, 3.5, we would love to be able to use 3.5, but we got it locked up. So now the question of like not, because we don't get to look into the, say, the grayish box, really black box of, you know, what especially DoD is doing all the time, is you're like, are they could be doing commercial. And then you're like, well, then why are we keeping all of this spectrum locked up on behalf of the military? But we want them to be safe. That's important. It's priority number one. But that gets us back again to the resiliency and security. So those commercial systems have to be as resilient and secure as anything that the military would, because you're really supporting, potentially supporting the military on them, as well as we all communications are precious, right? But so how do you ensure that? Is that part of we deal with encryption as a discussion here all the time, but is it a satellite version, you know, of the same thing, just keeping things encrypted along the way? Michael, you want to get in on this conversation?
Yeah, maybe I'll start off with an answer, then I'll kick it over to Michael to talk about the spectrum coordination angle, you know, of all of this. You know, first of all, just for like encryption, yeah, I mean, a lot of the same encryption technologies used for other applications in the internet, you know, can just be used over a satellite IP connection, you know, just as easily as they can over a terrestrial one. In terms of how we think about the resilience of these sort of systems, there's kind of different tiers or ways to think about resilience. I think you could think about it in a linear way, which is like, how easy or hard is it for this one satellite to be jammed, or this one satellite to survive, you know, a kinetic attack or a directed energy weapon or something like that, right? But there's a different way to look at resilience, which is the one I think that we're more focused on enabling, you know, through software, which is the ability of the system to react within seconds to find new paths or to reroute all of the scheduling and operations around the loss of any single satellite, or for systems to switch rapidly between satellite constellations, or to enable the US government to buy commercial service from a satellite operator in a geography where they don't currently have a contract and that operator is not placing a beam, but to do it in seconds or minutes, not in days, through an updated contractual negotiation between the government and that commercial company. So there's like a whole new level of resilience you can achieve when the software that powers these systems can react in tactically responsive timeframes to make the system kind of impervious to outages or effects to any individual ground station or terrestrial fiber link, even a submarine fiber link, that the system can be aware of kind of cuts or disruptions and then dynamically change the structure of the network around it.
So you could buy on the spot market, you're like, coming in.
Yeah, as our software technology SpaceTime becomes more widely, you know, adopted, you know, we have production contracts now and agreements with a number of the largest commercial satellite operators. So there's this network effect as the technology is adopted by more and more of them. They and the US government can now benefit from this more flexible, real-time, like on-demand coordination between each other, as well as the more flexible, rapid reconstitution of their own networks and outages. And so that pays dividends, you know, on the kind of resilience of these systems and their ability to withstand disruption. But that level of real-time sort of spot coordination can also make a massive difference for the efficient use of spectrum around the world, which is a valuable public good and public resource And that's one of the areas Michael's been focused on for us.
Yeah, we think that the innovation that we no longer, that these agreements to share spectrum or share infrastructure or share resources, which can be done much faster, this innovation of things, you know, what was originally like a pen and paper exercise that needed to be done over the course of days can be done over seconds. We think that that innovation ought to redefine what it means to use spectrum efficiently, right? We think that the use of spectrum should be defined in accordance to what is technologically possible. And now it is technologically possible and practical to share resources across multiple networks in a way that is economical and, you know, creates an efficient marketplace, right? And we think that that leads to the sort of good of everyone, right? And I think back to, you know, another point, of course, on the resilience piece is this type of resilience, the ability to pick and choose as many routes as possible, they are, all of these are like outs for any use case, right? And this is sort of what the DIU envisioned when they spelled out the hybrid space architecture, right? This idea of interoperability, broad interoperability leading to broad resilience across communication networks, right? And the ability, the marketplace is one of the you know, ways to do that.
But can you explain what DIU is?
So DIU is the Defense Innovation Unit.
Okay.
It is a part of the DoD, and its primary mission is to accelerate innovation for defense purposes.
And then you, Brian, you mentioned space-time. Is that a concept, a product, or both?
Yeah, space-time is a product. It's our software as a service offering. So it's the name of the software as a service that we provide to all of these commercial satellite operators and public sector organizations that implement this concept we call temporal spatial software-defined networks that kind of does the real-time orchestration of these networks that span land, sea, air, and space.
So also the other thing is sustainability, because there was a big concern, again, going back to the World Radio Conference is my main point on, I had a lot of discussions about this with the Kuiper and the other people, is how the geos are big on, you know, they don't take up as much space. They want seniority. They want to make sure that everybody, you know, appreciates they were there first, and the little guys need to, you know, give them leeway. They were kind of throwing everything at trying to get their point of view, as well as doing, the geos did a very good job of having an exceptional lobbying team, I understand. But so that's also, you know, so the whole idea of, you know, sustainability, once we get them up there, space junk, you know, those are things that I can only conceive of what we do. I have some kind of fun thoughts in my head of how that might go, but is sustainability something that we need to, we have the opportunity to, you know, proactively manage? I realize there's already a lot of equipment up there, but there sounds like a lot more is on its way.
Yeah, and a lot of what we're doing is enabling there to be even more. And so sustainability is on our mind, you know, to the point about coordinating the spectrum with these incumbents. First talking from an RF standpoint, and then I'll kick it over to Michael to talk more about a conjunction and collision management and space junk standpoint. But talking first about the spectrum standpoint, you know, the rules of the road on spectrum have been whoever has priority is there first, and any new entrants have to make sure they operate in a non-interference basis with the incumbents, right? So the geostationary satellite operators have these satellites, you know, every half degree along the geostationary arc. And it's important, and they've have rules that the first low Earth orbit satellites, the links from the, you know, from the Earth pointing back up at space, you have to make sure that there's not an inline, you know, vector pointing at that satellite that would cause interference to be received by a satellite in the geo arc behind it, you know, up higher in space. You have to make sure you're not in line with those higher things. So long as no one can steer their directional antennas, as long as their antennas are just like fixed, you know, pointed at the Earth, it's pretty simple to calculate those things. Like Michael said, it's more of like a pen and paper, you know, sort of exercise. But for the reasons that we started the show with, that people are moving towards more directional and steerable antennas. You know, what is interference? Like if I'm if I'm pointing at one angle, and someone else points a steerable antenna at 90 degrees opposed at an opposite angle, they don't interfere, right? Well, one of the challenges is that the companies that have these sort of steerable antennas, they don't tell anyone where they're pointing them. They're not incentivized to, because so long as they don't, the future entrants in the market have to assume the antenna could be pointed, in the exact wrong place, and they have to not operate.
Sorry to interrupt, but there's no obligation to be open about that information.
There is not, and there have been policy appeals to start, for certain commercial satellite companies.
Wait, what direction you're headed, I'm not going to tell you.
they're asking, please make these satellite companies broadcast a nowcast of this information so that I can better operate as a new entrant in the market. And the incumbents have every incentive not to disclose. And they'll say, well, that would divulge performance information or the locations of our customers. And so we'd rather not do that. And so part of what we're doing with our technology is we're enabling software to mediate these sort of things, where the primary user of the spectrum, right now, hopefully having convinced you that like our technology is allowing them to reorganize their network within seconds, the secondary user of the spectrum could say, could I please communicate along this vector over time? Right? Could I point my beam this way at this thing and emit on this frequency at this power? And even if it would cause interference to the primary, to the older system, well, maybe it could, within seconds, just adapt and take a micropayment or some other transaction, right? Kind of in an Uber-like context, right? Like what if there was this sort of, Uber for spectrum in space, right? Where it could be those that need it, those that have the resource, and those that want to use the resource. What if they could have ephemeral agreements that are on demand? And so we're not trying to impose that world, but we're trying to give the technologies to all the relevant actors should they decide to bilaterally and enter these sort of relationships between each other as commercial companies. We've given them the technology that would make it possible, and we believe that technology could make far more efficient use of spectrum and allow far more of these networks to exist than otherwise would, because otherwise it wouldn't make it, they wouldn't be able to get access to the spectrum to use it. And so because of that, we think a lot about sustainability and what will happen when there's so many more networks like this available in space.
Our hope is that in helping our customers and helping a single operator plan for a highly congested network, right, we're helping them change the way that they re-architect their own network in a way that makes them more amenable, like to collaborating with others in this new, more dynamic way, right? But I think the first part of this has to be, the first part of this can't be, because, a lot of the debates that we're seeing on the sustainability side of things, and, we're also part of this organization called the Earth Space Sustainability Initiative, which is an international organization that focuses specifically on these issues, is there's a lot of the same, people are making a lot of the same arguments that folks were made, like the arguments were made for industrialized countries polluting first and then closing the door behind them to prevent others, right? And so there is that theme to all this where the more established companies are being perceived as sort of closing the door behind them, or like, hey, this is the airspace. We don't need air traffic control in this airspace because this airspace is mine. I'm using it fine, right? But I think our view is that everyone needs air traffic control, even for their own spaces. And once you've learned how to wield like a modern air traffic control system for your own network, right, you're going to be able to get a lot more out of it. And everyone's going to get more a lot out of spectrum as a general matter.
Is that what you're referring to when you talk about an outer net?
Yeah, so I think the outer net is a broad term that envisions a space internet that is more reliable, more resilient, and globally available. I think it's a term that's been used by DoD and some other folks. And so in our case, there are specific APIs or specific endpoints which we think are relevant are sort of the common language which one operator would use to talk to another operator, right? And this is what we're calling the Outernet Council. This is an independent nonprofit organization, which we believe would be a good steward to define what is the common language between operators.
So with the Outernet, I guess my question is, as somebody who's grew up in the public policy networking space, are you thinking of it as a networking situation? So is this a thing of like the IETF coming in and helping with that? Or are you also thinking of the communications that take place as well? Are they both in this Outernet concept, or is it the kind of the network operation as standards? If you guys use that phrase, I know it gets touchy on standards. What's going on with the Outernet?
I think the most plain way to think about it is just to think about it like the internet, but in outer space. Right. So it's the concept of an outer space network. Right. And I think different people have different visions of how, just like different people have different visions of what the internet is. I think for us, we see value in, just like the terrestrial internet, there being a host of public standards which are necessary. The simplest way to think about it is to think about the plain meaning of the Outernet, which we would define as the internet, but in outer space. And just like the internet, just like the terrestrial internet, we think that there are a large number of standards that are relevant, communication standards that are relevant to people interconnecting and the construction and the building of an internet in outer space. And in the terrestrial internet, a lot of that was governed by the IETF, right? A lot of the internet standards, be it JPEG, GIFs, TCP/IP, they were governed by essentially standards organizations. And we think that one of the standards necessary for the construction and the creation of the Outernet is what we're calling the Federation API, which is the API that allows one operator to talk to another operator and share, you know, first define how do we connect, if we can connect, how do we connect, and how much is it cost to connect. And this is one of the building blocks which we think are the standards necessary for the creation of the Outernet.
And are people excited about this? Are they cooperating? Because I know how it's gone with the internet. Some people are really excited. Well, I mean, we're going through it again. It's we got everybody. There was no boundaries. It was awesome. You couldn't stop it because the way it was designed, right? It was in the early days. And then we kind of just said that's the way it's going to go. But, you know, we did not put it under standards. Part of that was to keep it from being regulated. And now we're seeing, you know, the Federation parts of it come back in. So have you learned certain things from also understanding how the internet works and is fragile that you are looking at for the Outernet to give it more resiliency?
Yeah, I think that if you look at the arc of history of every similar technology, whether it's the internet, whether it was how electricity was initially created, Westinghouse, a lot of the industry started off as being vertically integrated, right? So there was a lot of vertical integration, very little standardization and innovation, right? I think in the context of the internet, that analogy is like the AOL, right? And so you kind of see this trend of like AOL's decline being sort of correlated with massive innovation happening on the internet, right? And so we would like to, and also with terrestrial network operators, eventually regulators asked the existing operators to open up their networks to mobile virtual network operators, right? And so let's not wait 10 years for that to happen. Let's get to the end now, right? And I think we're still early days, but we're finding a lot of support for let's not wait forever and a day to get to what we know is the inevitable future of full interoperability, and let's compete on the things that we should compete on and not compete on things that should be commoditized as standards, right? When building anything big, when building an industrial base, when building large infrastructure projects across a large industrialized economies, there always is a need for commoditized things that are commoditized versus things that that you can compete on. And the things that are commoditized, for example, the USB interconnections in between our phones, it is that balance between the two that's super important. And we think that the ability to connect and the ability to, for satellite operators or telecommunication operators to communicate each other is just like the standardized ball bearings that you need to build like an industrial base. No one argues, no one tries to obfuscate, no one tries to hide the dimensions and the specifications of a ball bearing because it's something that everyone needs. And rather than wait 5 or 10 years for regulators to jump in, we think that there is already strong industry alignment that we need to get there as soon as we can.
It's amazing just all the things you must wake up and think about that I don't yet even know I should be thinking about, but are really important to getting this correct. But there is a definite fascination with space communication, especially now as we're seeing, you know, with the broadband build out, you know, not only in the United States, but across the world. And this does solve a lot of those areas where you're just not going to get there without it. When I first talked to the Project Kuiper people, I was like, all right, are they solving this for their own problem? And then it's just going to be like AWS, like they needed to build it. And they're like, hey, we can sell the extra capacity. And they've never told me that wasn't not the answer. But in my head, I think that's probably what it was and still is. But then they were not expecting to get, you know, the challenges of the first mover advantage, which they are now up against at the FCC because they're the darling of so many things. I love Amazon. It's probably packages coming to my house right now. And they just didn't ever think that they were going to they didn't expect some of the pushback that they have been getting because their others before them were well established in the space. So the whole idea of this area of the, you know, the stand, you know, whether or not you call it standardization, but the application layers of which need to be, you know, synchronous and work together for multiple reasons. One is just A, to work, but then to make sure that there's the resiliency and security. I feel a lot better knowing that you guys have already thought quite a bit about this. This is amazing. So give us one last thing we should be thinking about. Anything we should be go looking for? What's going on? Something that we should be looking, you know, something coming up in this summer, this fall that you guys have going on we should be anticipating?
I think we have a lot going on. There's probably more announcements coming. Okay. I think other exciting things that you have to look forward to from us is more updates about what we're doing with laser communications from space to ground. I think we talked a lot here about the software and the network and the orchestration. But as you get thousands of satellites in orbit, it becomes impractical to put a ground station under every one of them, right? That's why people have inter-satellite links. You read about the Amazon Kuiper and SpaceX Starlinks having 100 gigabits a second of optical laser links between satellites and the neighboring satellites to the northeast, south, and west. Well, as you aggregate all of that capacity back to maybe just dozens of ground station sites around the world, that connection becomes the bottleneck. And how do you get terabits a second between space and ground? So that I think requires laser communications and for them to work well through atmosphere. So that's a place you'll hear more from us about what we're doing in that space later this year.
Michael, do you want to add something?
Yeah, we hope to have more news on the Federation API. The nonprofit that is hosting the Federation API is called the Adirondack Council. And so we hope to have more news and more announcements about increasing traction and increasing adoption on that side of the house as well.
Fantastic. Well, please stay in touch. This is one of many things that, you know, me and my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute do to just get people to understand what's going on in this space. And, you know, as I always say, people in Washington, it's not that they want to love you. They're just really busy. So you have to kind of get in their face sometimes. And this is a great way for them to understand what they're up to and who they should be talking to. So thank you for being guests today on Explain to Chain. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been great.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Explain to Chain. For more episodes, subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred listening platform. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues to tune in. We'll see you on the next episode of Explain to Chain.